No propaganda, no lies, and definitely no BS.
You're with George Eliason,
live from Donbas, Ukraine, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to Friday, TNT Talk Radio. I'm George Eliason. Today we've got a great guest. Coming in today is the son of legendary journalist Robert Perry and a member of the board of Consortium News, which is by far one of the most stellar news and analysis platforms on the internet today. Hi, Nat. How are you today?
Hi, George. I'm good. Thanks for having me. It's good to be with you.
Well, thanks for coming on. Seriously. Now, because we're broadcasting live in Australia, some people may not be familiar with the platform or your father's history. And, you know, another thing is people look at investigative journalists of the quality that your dad is, and I mean, you know, all of you are brought up that way, as being something, okay, you're this, so now, you know, it's easy street, you know, and everything's over. And they really don't know what goes on behind this and the amount of work, blood, sweat, and tears. And I'd like to talk to you about that a little bit. Now, Nat and his brother Sam took over, you took over what, the board when your father passed away in January 2018? You carried Consortium.
We were invited onto the board at that time, that's right.
Okay. Now, you know, going through your dad's history, I was actually shocked to find out that your family used to own Middlesex News in Framingham, Massachusetts.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's right. I know you're from Massachusetts, so you might be familiar with Middlesex News. I don't even know if it still exists anymore.
But yeah, it still exists.
Is it still there?
It still exists.
Good. That's good to hear.
I actually grew up reading it.
Oh, did you? Okay. Yeah, it was published in out of Framingham, Massachusetts, which is a little bit outside of Boston. And it was I don't know if he was the owner or he was the publisher. My grandfather, William Perry, was the publisher of that. And that was my dad's first job, I believe, out of college. He was an English major at Colby College in Maine and the editor of the college newspaper there. And his first job in journalism was working for his father. And then he was, I think, pretty quickly hired by the Associated Press, and they, he moved to Baltimore, Maryland, and he was based there for a while and moved up to Providence and covered state and local politics there. And that's where I was born, 1976. And then in the late 70s, 77, 78, I moved down, or we all moved down to D.C. And he was, I guess, promoted and, you know, began covering national politics there. And so covered the Carter administration. And then he was put in charge of this investigative unit in, around 1980, about the time that Ronald Reagan was elected. And as he told the story, you know, he was, you know, put in charge of this investigative unit, but no one really, you know, told him what to work on. And he, you know, he realized that, you know, the Central America issue was shaping up to be a big priority of the Reagan administration. So that's where he sort of devoted his attention, and it turned out to be, you know, that kind of led into the Iran-Contra scandal, and that's where he really sort of made his name.
Yeah, he did, in a very big way. Now, up until that point, from what you can remember, I mean, it was just a typical, you know, home life, fairly typical. He's getting into investigative. Now, was that his first real brush with investigative journalism?
You mean at the Associated Press, covering the Reagan administration?
Yeah.
So they apparently they created I guess, you know, the AP was never, they didn't have a history of really doing investigative journalism. It's always been more of a sort of breaking news kind of outlet. But the way I understand it, you know, at some point in the late 70s, they decided to set up this investigative unit. And I would, well, you know, I would say that that was his first real, experience with investigative journalism. But I mean, he did, before that point, he was covering politics in Rhode Island. And, this is, so we recently published a collection of his writings. So I became much more familiar with his work in the 70s, which I had never read before, which is sort of what motivated me to pull the book together. One of the motivations, like I'd always heard, bits and pieces of the things that he had worked on sort of before I, came of age and began, reading his work in the mid 90s. So I wanted to go back and, get into some of the earlier work. And so
at that time, I can understand that.
He was covering the mob, Rhode Island politics in general, but Rhode Island politics at that time was kind of covering the mob because they had to.
It was crazy. Rhode Island politics was crazy.
Yeah. So this guy, Raymond Patriarca, he was sort of the head of the Providence Mafia. That's where he started.
When you started finding that out, that he was covering, people like Patriarca, listeners, you gotta think of it this way. In terms of the mafia, you had New York and Rhode Island, you had Rhode Island and Boston, and, a city as big and mafia driven as Boston bowed to Rhode Island. The Patriarchas ran everything. New England.
Yeah.
And that's the way it was.
Right.
So you had New York and then you had Rhode Island. Your eyes must have popped when you looked at those articles and found this out about your dad.
Yeah. It really hit me about, just the level of corruption, And I think this is something that you see, specifically in Rhode Island on that local level. Where the mob was, paying off the parole board, and they had Supreme Court justices on the state Supreme Court, and they had members of the state legislature, all in their pocket. It was really kind of pretty crazy, But at the same time, then when he went down to D.C., after covering those stories in Rhode Island, and then you see, covering the corruption in D.C. And at that time, I think one thing that was eye opening to me is, I was born in the 70s, but I was too young to know what was going on, of course, that there was a real effort to clean up Washington, clean up, all this corruption, so you had, campaign finance reform. That was a big thing in the 70s, of course, after Watergate and, a real effort to, clean up the corruption. And in Rhode Island, it was really the Republicans who were the anti-corruption party, you had, so this is one thing my dad would sometimes refer back to, and this is how I kind of knew about this background without having really, known the details, but he would sort of use that as a defense because at different times in his career, he would be sort of criticized as like, he only goes after Republicans. He doesn't care about the Democrats. But he would sort of, refer back to, I got my start in Rhode Island where, it was all the Democratic Party machine there that was, the source of the corruption at that time. And it was sort of the Republicans were the good government, party, at least at that local level. It did sort of open my eyes to, the background that, that led into, the 80s and, how, I don't know, how much things have changed, but, maybe not that much, but
did he ever feel that
corruption.
Talking to him about that, did he ever at any point feel he was in danger investigating the politicians around the Patriarchas, because in real terms they were very, very dangerous people.
I don't know, he didn't really talk about that much. He never really talked much about his background. I didn't know, for example, that he was arrested in D.C. at this anti-war protest in 1971. He was swept up at an anti-Vietnam War protest. I didn't know that till after he died. And this is actually sort of the genesis of the book as well, because one of his friends, his college buddy, Stephen Orlov, sent me an article he wrote in 71 about, you know, participating in this anti-war demonstration in DC and getting arrested in the largest mass arrest in US history. And I never heard that story, you know. So, I mean, it's a lot of these things that he just, you know, he just didn't talk about. He was never much of a, you know, self-promoter. But I think, I mean, from what I can tell, just reading his articles from that time, I mean, he seemed to be on pretty good terms with Patriarca. I mean, he would call, you know, that was his source, you know, he would speak on the phone with him and, you know, visit him in his coin-o-matic, probably money laundering operation or, yeah, but they, you know, they seem to be on pretty good. And that's one thing about my dad, I must say, like, not to toot his horns, but he always managed to, you know, develop these sources that, you know, I don't know, it's just something with in his personality and his, he's just sort of this trustworthy person. He just kind of won people's trust. So, you know, and, but yeah, who knows? I mean, he may have been in danger. But I think at the point that he was, you know, talking with Patriarca, I mean, he was, you know, out of prison at that time on parole and, you know, maybe not, you know, at the height of his career, which, you know, went back a long way. But yeah, maybe if it was, you know, 20 years earlier, it might have been a different story.
Oh, Patriarca himself was known as a gentleman, but it was the people under him and the people that took over for him.
Right.
They were a little bit less gentle, we'll say, if I remember correctly. So, I mean, that's an incredible story, you know, and to be there to write those stories. Now, you move down to D.C. He starts, you know, he takes over the investigative unit. What was he investigating before Iran-Contra? What was on the plate?
Well, I think, he took over this investigative unit. I think at the time of this, at the tail end of the Carter administration, and as the Reagan administration was coming in, and you know, in that transition period between, you know, November 1980 to January 81, there were some big developments in Central America, and one of the things one thing that happened at the time was this murder of these four American church women who were down in El Salvador, Catholic church workers doing humanitarian work down there, and they were murdered by the Salvadoran death squads. And you know, this was a big national story. And you know, Reagan's foreign policy advisor Jean Kirkpatrick, who later became the ambassador to the UN, she sort of, you know, justified these murders and said, well, you know, they weren't really nuns. They were actually more like political activists. And, you know, and I think that really set my dad off, like that, like, wait a minute, like, so it's okay to, you know, murder political activists. And so, I mean, you know, that was one of the big stories, but, you know, in general, he could see that, you know, Central America was shaping up to be a big area of focus, you know, so the Nicaraguan revolution had just happened in 1979. And, so the Sandinistas were in charge and, you know, Reagan was making a lot of, you know, statements about how this was the new front of the Cold War, and a lot of people were worried that it was shaping up to be a new sort of Vietnam War. And
right.
So one of his stories at that time was he investigated the backgrounds of some of the foreign policy team that Reagan was pulling together, and so he described how they all had their backgrounds in the Vietnam War. And, all these people who kind of were architects of that war. So he could sort of see the writing on the wall that this is going to be a defining, you know, area for the Reagan administration. And so it started, and the original focus was really El Salvador in the early 80s. And then Nicaragua became, you know, more of the focus. And that was partly because, well, the Nicaraguan Contras were, you know, committing all these atrocities and, you know, massacres of farm workers and things like that, and so Congress cut off funding. And then, but then immediately the Reagan administration started trying to figure out ways around this congressional ban, and that eventually turned into the Iran-Contra affair. But he was following that all very closely. And I think, like, one of the things he's always mentioned, when he talks about that, that history was that, you know, that it wasn't, you know, he, as a sort of modest person, you know, he really wouldn't take that much credit for it. He would just say, you know, it didn't take a genius to figure this out, because it was kind of obvious. I mean, you know, anyone who would just sort of follow the leads, and it was kind of an open secret in Washington, but just nobody else wanted to touch it, you know? So it was sort of, you know, he had this
lane. Yeah, but that's the thing.
Yeah.
That's just the point of the, you know, we're talking before internet. I remember the stories plastered all over media before Iran-Contra came out, before your dad wrote that series. It was how good these Contras were, how they were freedom fighters, how they were heroes, how they were this, how they were that, and the other thing. And that was media everywhere. There wasn't one real story until your dad started writing it that said otherwise, which is part of what gave your dad's article shock value in the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one of the things he, a lot of this came out later, you know, when with the Iran-Contra, the congressional investigation documents would come out that showed just how aggressive that the Reagan administration was in developing their public diplomacy apparatus. And they had office at the State Department, and the White House was involved, and they used the term perception management. And this is a theme that my dad would return to over and over, because, you know, it came to be sort of this defining characteristic of, our modern political reality, that's what, you know, the Washington establishment is, you know, they're seeking to sort of build this conventional wisdom and perception management to get people to see things in a certain way, to see, you know, the Contras as the good guys and, you know, Sandinistas as bad guys, and put, you know, white hats on these guys and black hats on these guys. Mm-hmm. And this part of that was a very aggressive, you know, strategy they had of going after anyone who stepped out of line, you know. So you had Raymond Bonner at the New York Times, and his partner, Alma Gimaperto, who wrote the article about who exposed the El Mazote massacre in El Salvador. Mm-hmm. And they were, their careers were destroyed because just the administration just, they put pressure on the editors. They just, they call up the bureau chiefs and, you know, just put this pressure on and say, you know, they're crazy, they got the story wrong. And so many of the editors were just, you know, they would just sort of buckle under pressure and, you know, retract the stories and, you know, fire the journalists that got the stories right. So a lot of journalists just learned, okay, if, you know, you want to keep your job, you know the limits of what you're allowed to report on, and you don't want to take risks, you know, if people with six-figure salaries.
Now your dad built his life after, you know, I don't know if he knew that when he wrote this story, but afterwards he surely did, because all the ramifications, all the fallout.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, from there on, as long as consortium's been in existence, he's always bucked that. He's always, you know, okay, well, you know, there will be ramifications. You have to know your limit. He didn't seem to know his limit. He just, this is the reality. This is the evidence. This is the truth. And this is what we print.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he was a risk taker, you know, he did take risks, you know, and I mean, that's something I do admire him for, because, you know, we all have to make those decisions, you know, like you want to, you know, cash in your retirement. Like, that's what he did with, you know, he cashed in his pension and started Consortium News. And, you know, like, that's where he got the seed money for starting that. And, you know, that's, it takes some risk, but he believed in what he was doing. And, you know, he sort of chose to go that route. I mean, I think it's also, it depends on, you know, who your heroes are. And like, people he looked up to were always people like, you know, I.F. Stone and, you know, George Seldes. I mean, these are his inspirations. And so So I think that's right. What I'm sort of hired to.
Nat, we've got to take a break. I want to, when we come back, I want to back up a little bit. And right now we're talking about post Iran-Contra. I want to get back into a little bit, you know, as it happened when we come back, and then get back into this right here, because, you know, the amount of courage that, you know, especially this part of his history. And, you know, I think all investigative journalists, that's what you do. We'll be right back. I'm George Elias, and this is TNT Talk News Radio. See you in a second.
You should hear what Mike Ryan's talking about.
The ABN is not anti-vaccination, nor are they pro-vaccination. They are pro-choice. Meryl, thanks for joining us.
Mike, thank you so much for having me on again. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Dr. Tess Laurie says there's no evidence that these jabs will be beneficial for children. What do you think about that?
Well, it's absolutely the case. It's actually the case for anyone under the age of 30, because they are at such a low level of risk from a COVID infection, if that even is a thing, that the only thing they're actually at risk from is the risk of the jab, not at all from the risk of the infection. And infants and young children are known to not be at risk, and most of them have already had COVID and recovered from it. So, you know, there is no benefit for them. There is only risk.
Mike Ryan on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I've got muscular dystrophy. That means my muscles are weak and it can be hard to breathe. During COVID-19, kids like me are at a greater risk. But the Muscular Dystrophy Association is here to help.
MDA is what ensures they receive critical medical care at one of over 150 care centers.
COVID-19 won't stop us. Please visit helpmda.org.
Mama, what does the chicken say? Dog. Cat. Giraffe.
Giraffe, really? Giraffe.
You're not going to get it all right. Just make sure you nail the big stuff, like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Mainstream media censors, smears, and intimidates those telling the truth. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Do you have a suggestion for a possible guest or host you'd like to hear on TNT Radio, or perhaps a topic you feel we should discuss? Then we want to hear from you. Simply complete the suggestion form on the TNT Radio website. Help us make a difference on TNT Radio. Now we're back with Nat Perry, and we're talking about his father's work and his life growing up in that family. As your father was doing the Iran-Contra investigation, was there a point during his work itself? I mean, it's very structured, and you get so immersed in it. It's for me anyway, I don't notice what's going on outside, never mind, you know, what's around the corner. Was there a certain point where he knew that there was going to be all the ramifications you talked about coming down on him?
Well, I think, it was a sort of daily struggle, really, to get his stories published. And, you know, I do remember growing up and, sitting at the dinner table and, I guess typically for a lot of families, the dad would sort of air his grievances, his work grievances or whatever. But, I do remember hearing, him talk about how, his editors were blocking his stories, and, it didn't matter how many sources he had or how many documents he had to back up the sources' claims. His editors were very timid, but I think he was. But generally, the AP would put his work out, even if it was if they were a bit timid and not always always that thrilled with it, even though he was doing good work and he would win awards. He won 84 the George Polk Award. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. So on one hand, they were getting those accolades, but you know, they're also feeling the pressure from the administration. And one of the more humorous stories from that time is that, you know, he wrote the first story with his partner Brian Barger about the Contra cocaine trafficking, which is sort of preceded the Iran-Contra. In that period from like 84 to 86, when Congress put the ban on, when they banned funding the Contras, they were trying all sorts of different ways to circumvent the legal prohibition, and the sales,
right?
The arms sales to Iran came a little later, but like in that period of 84, 85, they were trying all these different schemes, and one of them was cocaine trafficking. And this became it was one of these stories that he had, I think he said something like 25 sources or something like that, like two dozen.
24 sources. Yeah.
Yeah. 24 maybe. Yeah. And, but it didn't matter. It was such an explosive story. And it was, I mean, if you think back to the 80s with, the crack cocaine explosion and, the war on drugs and Nancy Reagan's Just Say No campaign. I mean, to then say, hey, the government's actually tolerating cocaine trafficking. I mean, it's just beyond, what people were willing to believe. You know what I mean? So that was something they wouldn't publish until it was actually published by a mistake in the AP's Spanish language service. Somehow there was a mix-up, and the papers in Latin America published the story, and so the English AP service then sort of scrambled to put the story out.
Had to follow suit.
Exactly. So, yeah. I mean, there were...
Yeah, it's a good thing they did,
that was a big story. And I mean, that, served as the basis sort of for Gary Webb's follow-up a decade later. And so it's good that, and it served as a bit for John Kerry's investigation. At that time he was a young senator from Massachusetts and, was very disturbed by these reports of Contra cocaine trafficking and opened an investigation that really uncovered a lot of details about it.
It was the biggest story of the decade. I mean, that's what it was. It was the biggest story of at least that decade. Now, for the audience, in case you don't know, to constitute a fact in news, you need two sources. Two sources make a fact. You need multiple facts to, register it as evidence. So if you're looking at 24 sources, now we're just talking sources, not the facts that they're saying, okay? Because they're going to, on a story like this, they're going to agree on different points, which constitutes more facts, okay, each source. 24 sources is an incredibly huge amount of sources for one story. It's massive. And to be told that that's not enough, that's what you call fighting. You're fighting a tsunami at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I think, it becomes clear, that it's not about, these journalistic principles of, there's this saying like an extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. And it's like, okay, look, we have the evidence and everything. You couldn't ask for any more evidence at this point, but then that's
exactly right.
It's just like they're doing it because they know this is too much, like the pressure they'll come under from the administration. I think, I mean, for me, that's always been when I learned about this story of the Contra cocaine and some of the other related issues. I mean, it really kind of drives home what the limits are. I think if you look at the media, read the New York Times, I mean, you'll find some good journalism. I mean, even Noam Chomsky, one of the biggest media critics, will say that the New York Times is one of the best newspapers in the world. And there is some you know, it's worth reading because they do give you some news. But some of these, some stories like the Contra Cocaine issue and you know, others like that, you know, they kind of, they let you know what the limits are, you know. And I think that's why that's what's so useful about, you know, getting into this, some of this history and, you know, refreshing your memory and, you know, always kind of going back and, you know, looking at the history that, you know, so we tend to get so focused on current events and what's going on day to day. But, you know, it's worth taking some time to go back.
It's always worth celebrating the heroes. You know, I focus mostly on investigative journalism, long form. And it's people like your dad. You know, I've had some pretty interesting circumstances. You know, and so you can look at the history, and you know, your dad is a giant. You know, I'm not going to whitewash it. He's just stellar journalist. And okay, well, he never stopped either. He never stopped.
No.
And now with Iran-Contra, what was his reaction after finding out his boss, who didn't like his 24 sources, which covers everything, I mean, it's just mind-boggling, you know, was conferring with Oliver North on a regular basis about the story?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he realized that at that point.
Your dad must have fell off the chair.
Yeah. I mean, he was so frustrated, I think, at that point when you get in, like, you know, 1986, you know, that this phony reality was winning, you know, that it didn't matter. I think he was, you know, just sort of resigned, you know, to the reality that, you know, the truth would not come out. And, you know, despite all his efforts and the efforts of a few other journalists, that, you know, this phony reality would win. But then what happened was that this supply plane was shot down over Nicaragua, and Eugene Hassenfuss was the lone survivor. And then that broke it out into the open, that, like, oh gee, maybe there was something here after all. And because they were caught red-handed, you know, this CIA operative was shot down and taken into custody by the Sandinistas, and the, you know, the weapons were, you know, laying in a smoking plane, you know, in the countryside of Nicaragua. You know, so it's like, okay, yeah, maybe there was something here after all. So, but then that's when it broke open. So, I mean, on one hand, it's like, yeah, I guess vindication, because, you know, he had been writing these stories and, you know, coming under pressure, and, you know, that it, and it seemed like that the administration would have succeeded in, you know, painting its false reality if it wasn't for that, you know, that incident. And that's when it broke wide open.
Now, you're what, 10, 12 years old at this point?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, 10 or 11.
You know, the amount of stress that he must have been under, you know, work stress. And then it must have become pretty apparent that, you know, his work life could change dramatically at any moment. What was it like growing up? Knowing that, he didn't talk to you about the story he was writing, did he? Or why?
Well, I guess at that age, you know, you don't really know exactly what's going on, but, you know, you're beginning to sort of, you know, follow what's happening in the world. And, you know, I remember being very proud of him, you know, like whenever, you know, I was asked, what does your dad do? And I was always very proud to say he's an investigative reporter, you know, and so I knew, like, that what he did was important. But it wasn't until probably, you know, a few years later, and probably not till like college, when I started really, you know, going back and, you know, reading his books, Fooling America, Trick or Treason, and, you know, kind of really getting into, and then I began working for him. You know, he when he launched the magazine, IF magazine, in 97, you know.
You and your brother wrote a book with him later on.
Yeah. So, yeah, we worked on he started a little publishing house, and they published books, Lost History and October Surprise X-Files. And so, that was a very exciting time, for me. It seemed like very, hopeful. He had this idea of really building a new news media. So he didn't really look at it like just some one-off project, but that, we needed to build a new news media. And so it was fun.
So you started working for him. Was he a demanding publisher to work for?
I think he was. Yeah, he's demanding of himself for sure. He seemed to produce most of the content. He would always have at least two or three of his own articles in the magazine. The magazine would come out every 2 months, and we had a newsletter that came out every 2 weeks. And at that time, he was main one producing the content, but it was over time he began attracting more and more writers. And I guess it was demanding in some ways, but it's always very, very fun and exciting to do.
Now, after Rencontra, you're starting to get the fallout for it, but it's going, it is being investigated, but he was essentially blackballed after that, no?
Yeah, well, I guess that would come a little later. So after the AP, I guess he wasn't on the best terms with his editors there, but then he moved to Newsweek. And, that was in the late 80s, around 1990 probably. And he worked there for a couple of years, but it turned out that he found that it could be even a more sort of restrictive environment than AP, and they were even more cautious, and it didn't end up on the best of terms. And then he left Newsweek and worked for Public Broadcasting System on this the October Surprise. So going back to the beginning of the Reagan administration era, the origins of it, where basically they had sabotaged President Carter's negotiations to get these American hostages out of Iran. He worked on that. And I think that's really when it kind of, in his investigation into that, he came across a treasure trove of classified material that wasn't meant to be seen by anybody, but it was part of the House of Representatives investigation into the October Surprise mystery. And they sort of buried all this evidence that showed that it most likely did happen. And the Reagan campaign had, subverted, sabotaged Carter's hostage negotiations.
Yeah.
And
I actually looked into it.
That's what he kind of really was marginalized, I would say. So just to answer your question, I think after that, he just gave up on the mainstream media because nobody wanted to touch this story, even though he had this, this amazing treasure of classified material, and no one wanted to touch it. So that's when he said, okay, that's when that's sort of the final straw, and when he decided to launch the website and the magazine.
I actually rediscovered some of that evidence. And, I used the term rediscovered. I looked into that too, and it was just mind-boggling, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
You lay it all out on the table, and it shows the extent of, foreign and negative charge politics into, national campaigns. Would be the lightest way of saying it. So, he went through this. Now, like I said, he's not, and quite frankly, the story itself is inspirational for, and it should be for any journalist. But, where you're talking about all these publications being careful, you see that a lot today. I'm not as kind about it as you are, I guess. I've experienced the same thing, in terms of that. But it's publications that they know the story. They know it's real. You know, in your dad's case, you know, I still can't get over the number, 24 sources. Wow. That just, it's mind boggling for me. You know, it just, okay. You know, it'd be like 24 sources. Okay, Bob, lay it out. Hey, here's an advance. Get it going.
Yeah. And and the reason there were so many sources, and like, this is what I sort of rediscovered, you know, working on the reader that I recently published.
It had to be.
He had all these sources because there were people, these like right-wing Americans who supported the Contra effort. They wanted, they wanted the Contras to you know, win the war against the Sandinistas, but they knew that they were involved in cocaine trafficking. And so they were blowing the whistle from, I mean, they, you know, so these were like a lot of them, some of them were, you know, sources he had in Nicaragua, you know, people in the Contras and, you know, but he also had these, you know, right-wing Americans based in Miami or DC or wherever who they all knew about this activity and they wanted to stop, you know, so they wanted to, that's why they were coming forward. And, but, you know, it didn't matter. You know,
a bridge too far.
24 or 100 or whatever, like the media just wasn't, they didn't want to cover this. It's just too, and the same with like the October surprise, like you said, I mean,
well, they're actually related.
You know where the limits are because, like, it's just too, you know, too explosive.
But if a publication knows that there's a story there, and they're if a publication knows that there's a story there, and they're brought the story, okay, This is a you know, a sticking point for me. And shouldn't they, I mean, isn't it akin to lying if you're a news publication to, okay, deny the story? Or, you know, in the case of this, they were actually saying, well, it's the opposite. And when we get into Gary Webb, I mean, they did basically the same thing, only worse. You know, the guy committed suicide with two bullets. Come on, you know, that's kind of stretching it a little bit. But
yeah, no, you're right. It is lying. I mean, it's a form of like you're deceiving the people. You're misleading people. You're trying to anyway, the word escaped. But you know, you're.
You're an arbiter of reality. You're not a news organization. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, it's very, and you're destroying your own credibility, you know, and at this point, I mean, how many of us really believe what we, you know, what the media is telling us? Like, I tend not to, you know, put too much stock into anything that I, you know, because you know, you've been deceived so many times and, you know, it's like, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Right?
No, I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
You know, and you look at the current media war. Okay, it is an info war. Do you realize that in the early to mid 2000s, it was mainstream media that was trying to warn the world that, you know, this is a possibility, and they were doing it pretty hard. Okay, and then no one listened. No one listened to them. They were actually publishing articles by insiders that were challenging the CIA. And the CIA was answering in editorials. The head of the CIA wrote two editorials to address a whistleblower that was saying, listen, this is going on and we have to stop it. And he agreed, we have to stop it, but we're not ready to stop it right now. We can't. We're going to phase it out. And then the second editorial a few years later, and it was the game changer and media changed at the same time, was, we're not changing anything. This is working really well for us right now.
Yeah.
Okay, that's addressing one person who was complaining about all this stuff, you know, and the woman should have been a national hero, but instead, no one even knows the story.
Right.
That's the kind of thing your dad You know, it's bread and butter, for God's sake. It's just how much import Iran-Contra and the story surrounding that he wrote has. It was a game changer for the country.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to mention, speaking of the CIA, and along the lines that you were talking about, we had in the 80s, I mean, one of the problems of intelligence was this politicization of the intelligence agencies, where, historically, despite all the, wrongdoing that they may have done, at least on the operational side of the CIA, much of their analytical work was, basically trustworthy, and they took seriously their role as, analysts and, collectors of intelligence and to give the information to the president that they needed. But what you had in the 80s was just a complete, purging of the agency of all the honest analysts and putting people in charge, who would produce intelligence that was just, just politicized and that was geared towards, they wanted the policy to be, okay, Nicaragua is a threat, and we're going to put all our efforts into overthrowing the Sandinistas. So, okay, let's shape the intelligence around that. So, and you had whistleblowers at the time for, coming out later in the, especially when Robert Gates was nominated, to head the CIA, who, people like Melvin Goodman in the CIA, who came forward and said, what they've done to this agency has destroyed its credibility and its ability to produce quality intelligence. And and that's another sort of story that's been really ignored. And one of the things my dad really was critical of Bill Clinton for, because he had an opportunity in the 90s to sort of remedy some of that and to get rid of the neocons, and but instead they just kind of stayed in their positions, and Clinton just he basically wanted to focus on his domestic agenda and didn't feel any need to take on the CIA or and get involved with these sort of more national security issues. And there have been plenty of whistleblowers that have tried to raise the alarm about what's going on with the intelligence agency.
Well, it's kind of funny. I'm glad you brought up Gates, because for the life of me, I can't remember her last name, Rita somebody or other. Her and her partner were the most trusted intelligence sources for Robert Gates. Okay, and her pedigree, right before she became the most trusted person in United States intelligence, she was a cashier at a gift shop. She just networked very well. And right now, her agency is one of the most powerful private intel agencies in the world. Oh, gosh, I can't think of her last name, but I will. The articles that you edited at Consortium that I wrote in 2018, covered this.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was a whole school of them,
Remember, you did some really good work also exposing the proper knot outfit. And that was one of the things I remember, so when my dad, passed away unexpectedly in early 2018, I mean, that was like one of his main focus, one of the areas of focus was, what we saw bubbling up in terms of disinformation outfits, people that are trying to expose this network of Russian agents and all this ridiculous stuff. So I mean, Consortium News came under a lot of came under attack at that time. And I remember he really felt that you know, the Clinton people were behind a lot of this stuff. And
it was all under contract for them. I came up with the people that wrote the list. There was actually two lists that they combined, and the people running the site. The big takeaway was the PropOrNot site is inside a server at the U.S. State Department, inside what today is the ASGM. That was the big takeaway.
What's ASGM?
It used to be the Board of Broadcasting Governors. They do, all the State Department publications. They also, the BBG is like an ambassadorship for U.S. media heads. All right. So they go in there. And so, you know, if they're on the board, you know that if the NBC head is on the board, you know, NBC is pushing whatever policy the State Department wants. And they brought in these contractors that created PropOrNot. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's RFERL and Radio Free, Europe, right. Radio Liberty. PropOrNot's on the same server. Anyway. So they've got this, but after 2012, when Obama, 2011, Obama changed what's the name of the act? Boy, I'm telling you.
Oh, the NDAA. NDAA?
No, it wasn't the NDAA. It was media. It was prohibiting propaganda in the United States. They actually changed it, rewrote it, so they could do InfoWars inside the U.S. Mm-hmm. Okay. That made all of this legal.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that needs to happen to stop it dead and make it all illegal again is this act, which was revised in 2012, needs to revert back. That's it.
Yeah.
Stops all of it dead because the source that justifies it is no longer there. And so it makes even what Twitter's doing right now, the deplatforming everything, it makes it illegal again, you know, which is a big thing, but nobody has any interest in doing these things. Now we've got 3 minutes left. And quite frankly, I want a huge plug for Consortium News from you.
Well, we've been around since 1995.
Who's writing there now? Who's writing there now that you're excited
about? The editor-in-chief is Joe Loria. He has pretty similar background to my dad in a lot of ways. Began in the mainstream media, worked for several large
Joe's an excellent
newspapers.
Journalist.
Yeah, great journalist. Been doing a lot of great work on Julian Assange, you know, really taking up the cause of Julian Assange to try to get him freed out of this prison in London. A lot of good writers. We have I'm sort of drawing a blank trying to think of all the
he's got a lot of award-winning writers.
John Pilger, he's a regular contributor, and John Kiriakou. We have Margaret Kimberly, Chris Hedges is a contributor and on the board of directors. Mm-hmm. Patrick Lawrence, who's been a contributor for many years. So, you know, we take
it's like an all-star lineup.
Yeah. I mean, we take a very, you know, skeptical view, but evidence-based journalism that really tries to, you know, correct a lot of the false narrative that you see in the media, and nonpartisan and willing to go against the grain of and take a very independent perspective on what's going on in the world. So very, very proud to be on the board of directors there, and
Larea's
plug our what's that
Lurie's also expanded consortium into other areas. And, you know, I think that's pretty exciting too. Consortium is doing video now. Is that right?
Yes. CN Live, yeah, he does, he's very, very well done long form with discussions with journalists. And so, yeah, you can find that on YouTube and all the platforms, CN Live. And I would also recommend if you go to the website, check out on the right hand column, the new reader that we've just published, which is a collection of my dad's writings from 1971.
Forget about 10 seconds.
2018. So check that out. American Dispatches, Robert Berry reader.
Okay. Nat Berry, thank you so much for coming in.